Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
On Friday, October 19th, the Norris Group proudly presents its fifth annual award-winning event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts joins Bruce Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. Proceeds for the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude's Children's Research Hospital. This event would not be possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: Foreclosure Radar and Sean O'Toole, the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, and President Bill Tan, Investors Workshops and President Sean Watkins and Angel Bronskiest, Invest Club for Women and Iris Veneration and Bobby Alexander, San Jose Real Estate Investors Association and Geraldine Berry, Fry Wiles, MVT Productions, and White House Catering. Learn more about the panel and how to attend at isurvivedrealestate.com.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today our special guest is Eric Jensen. Eric is an economic analyst with more than two decades' experience as a technology industry executive and venture capitalist. In 1998, he founded iTulip.com, a financial analysis company with an amazingly accurate forecasting record. Eric is also the author of The Post-Catastrophe Economy. Eric, welcome back.
Hey, Bruce. Great to be here.
Be delighted to have you on the panel at I Survive Real Estate. It's going to include a whole new demographic. We have a gentleman that's the vice president of Carrington, which is one of the billion-dollar piles of money that's interested in residential real estate in California. And I know you come from the hedge fund world, and all of a sudden, I would say in the last 6 months, it's been obvious that California real estate is what they consider a smart bet, and they have literally been buying everything in sight. And what's interesting that we've never really had a market maker in the real estate world be such a dominant player that they almost can create their own outcome. Mm-hmm. But since they've shown up, inventory has gone from 6 months to 1 month.
Right.
And all of a sudden, every time you have something for sale, there's got to be 20 offers that show up inside of 2 days. And we're having price increases because of it.
Yeah, that's not surprising. The way that the hedge fund and fund world works is it's a relatively small community, and they do tend to operate as a herd. And, you know, the theme for the last several years has been a lack of yield and a very small number of opportunities to go after. One of the funds that I invested in, a fund called Eastham Capital, and they're not investing in real estate, but actually multifamily properties on the theory of rising rents, and that's been going very well. But I also am in contact with a fair number of other managers, such as the ones that you're running into, who have all decided that housing had pretty much bottomed, and that with mortgage rates at 3% fixed rates, that you can do a simple calculation that it's very unlikely that home prices will not appreciate at an average rate of 3% over 30 years. And so that you're likely to make money in capital gains on real estate, if you can lock in those fixed rates and buy at what appears to be a market bottom.
Well, what's interesting is that California, in many areas, the price of the home is actually less than the cost to build by considerable. And it would seem like the math will catch up with it. Eventually, we'll have enough demand to where we'll have to build something, and then that should be a very profitable day for those people that have bought and held some of this.
That seems to be true. And, of course, the headline news since the latest Case-Shiller data came out is that home prices are up in the 20 major cities year over year quite considerably. Now, we've had a bounce before. We had people forget, but in early 2010, prices went up as well. And so it's not absolutely clear whether we are at the bottom in prices will continue to rise from here, or if we're having another bounce on the way down. But the fact is that, you know, back when I was first writing about housing, housing bubble in 2002, around this time of year, actually, what I identified was the loss of the normal correlation between regional incomes and home prices, which is generally an indication of a bubble in real estate. And what appears to be happening is that prices are recorrelating to incomes, and you have some areas of the country where prices are going up, and other areas where they're still not doing well. And it really depends on how well the regional job market is doing, whether incomes are rising.
You know, I don't know if I'm typical of most buyers of real estate, but my wife and I started out with, you know, buying a $20,000 home that turned into a $35,000 home, and when we bought a new one at $39,000, and we took the net proceeds and we put it as a down payment, and our payment really didn't change, and then it went to the 39 grand one went to 85, and we took that 50 grand and put it down on a 121, and our payment really didn't change very much. And then we took that money and we built a custom home, and we had the same payment for the custom home as we did the first home. And the progression of price, though, was astonishing of, you know, what we were living in, but our payment never changed. And so when you look at a ratio of saying, okay, what are the people's incomes and does it support the price? Sometimes it's supported by the fact that they brought an awful lot of cash from the former ownership. And I don't know how you calculate that in.
Well, you have to keep in mind that we've been living in a very unusual period of time since the early 1980s. I'm not sure when you started your...
Home buying.
Yeah, right about there. Well, that was right after we'd had a big inflation. And
And I owned a home in the mid-70s, so I was the benefactor of my house amazingly turning into a whole big pile of money.
Sure. And, well, nominally anyway. I mean,
yes.
The problem is that it felt like your price was going up, but that was the period of time when housing was only keeping up with the rate of inflation. It just felt like you were making some money.
Well, I owned three of them, and so that was probably what felt good, is that I had three piles going up instead of one.
Well, you got to keep your money. Anybody who was in cash obviously lost their money.
So yes.
That was the right thing to do. But subsequent to that, you know, when the Volcker Fed stepped in and hammered the economy into the ground to stop the inflation spiral, interest rates are quite high. They're in double digits. It's almost hard to imagine that a 30-year treasury bond, non-callable, was trading at, I think, like 13% or 14%.
Mm-hmm.
And those are only now maturing, you know, just recently. Which meant that everybody at that time was convinced that inflation was going to go on forever. Now everyone is convinced that inflation will never appear ever again. I think my theory is that everyone's wrong again, but in the other direction. But anyway, starting in 1983, interest rates have been declining continuously.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason that you've been able to move into one house after another without paying more is because the interest expense keeps falling, and the monthly cost of owning keeps falling, even if the sticker price on the house is going up.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I don't owe anything, but that it was the progression of what happened when I was, you know, in that mode. Eric, on your cover of your book, and it's the toughest book I've ever read. I was on vacation. I might have told you this before. I was on vacation on a cruise, and I probably brought four or five books with me. And I read each of the other books inside of half a day, and it took me 8 days to read yours. So,
I'm not sure if to take that as a compliment or not. But.
Well, yeah, it was more of it's kind of a document where you go, okay, well, I'm going to have to reread that to completely grasp it, because it's not just technical, but it's dense in its in what it brings. And so on the cover, you've got the America looking like it's getting a tune-up, and the subtitle is Rebuilding America and Avoiding the Next Bubble. You had hoped we would head in a certain direction and get the ship righted, if you will. Have we made strides in getting there?
I would have to say, to a certain degree, yes, but not nearly as much as we could have. We clearly spent a great deal of the nation's limited credit that it has remaining trying to reflate the housing market. And we haven't really addressed the biggest area of the economy that is really weighing down on households, which is the cost of and expense of health care. It is the one thing that really stands out in personal consumption expenditures of households like a sore thumb over the last 30 years. It keeps growing and growing and consuming more and more people's incomes. That you could do more to stimulate the economy by reducing that cost and doing anything else. But you know, looking forward to the future, the book didn't focus on that as much as on issues around energy and energy costs as we go through this what I call the peak cheap oil era, which began back in 1998. And has really changed the dynamics of the way that the energy market works, which is driven entirely by oil prices. So what I was hoping for is that we would take some of that money that we have been spending on trying to rebuild what I refer to as the fire economy and focus it on productive businesses that specifically are aimed at solving our energy problems. And most of those that are really practical that we can do are related to conservation. I spoke at the BOMA conference last year in Florida. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with the Building Managers Association. It's basically a commercial real estate group.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd suggest to them is one of the ways that they can make the money is to spend some time retrofitting buildings to reduce energy expenses. That falls right into cap rates and improves the return both on a cash flow basis and capital valuation basis of commercial buildings. And some of them went out and actually did it, and they're pretty happy they have.
Okay.
So there's lots of ways to actually make a bunch of money off solving this problem, and the problem being that the energy intensity of our economy, the amount of energy it takes to generate a dollar of GDP growth is still too high and will continue to grow as oil prices rise.
The presidential election, you have a feeling about how that's going to go and the ramifications of either one of them winning?
Well, I'll tell you, Bruce, it's a really close race, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think at the moment, last time I checked, Romney was slightly ahead. I thought that the convention, the first day of the convention yesterday, went pretty well for the GOP, and I think there's a chance that Mitt Romney could win this election. I think, on balance, that would be better for the economy if that happened. Would certainly be better for the real estate industry, although I think it's actually a bit of a wash either way. But I do think it would be better for the country.
The health care bill, as it's been passed, does that solve anything? Does it get us cheaper?
Well, Bruce, the political third rail that you can't touch no matter what party you're in is the fact that insurance companies are adding an incredible amount of inefficiency to the healthcare system. No other country does it this way, and the thing that has to be done is they have to be taken out of the loop somehow, and they have to get back to a system where the individual consumer is making decisions on costs, and the market can operate again to set prices for healthcare.
Okay. The fiscal cliff that everybody's talking about, that we've chosen to ignore in 2012 because it's election year, which I kind of was surprised at. But so 2013, it's not going to be an election year. What do you see that could happen? Do you think we're going to make some hard decisions and get the fiscal house in order?
Well, the problem with the whole framework of debate about the fiscal or fiscal problems is that all of the and you know forecastable and foreseeable problems that we're having now with our fiscal position are a result of excessive leverage in the private sector, just too much debt. I think I mentioned to you before we started that I'm a member of the Boston Economics Club, and we meet at the Boston Fed every month. And one of the recent meetings was Janet Yellen was there giving a speech, and I spoke with her after the meeting. And I asked her, you know, how it was going to be possible to address the fiscal problems that we're having that the Fed is continuously warning Congress about as being a predecessor of some pretty painful increases in debt costs and interest rates in the future, and how that's going to be addressed if the economy is currently dependent on about $4.50 of new debt creation for every dollar of GDP growth.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because every time that that ratio becomes a problem, as it did in 2008, the government has to step in and fill the gap. And in other words, if the private sector isn't lending all that money into existence, the government has to. And when the government does, its balance sheet gets worse and worse. So really what it comes down to is, what are we going to do to reduce this dependence on credit to grow the productive economy, the real so-called real economy? And she didn't have an answer, and I don't think anybody has a good answer, because it's one of those things that once you get on that treadmill, it's pretty tough to get off of it.
Okay. So, yeah, sort of kicking the can down the road. Is there a point, and the fiscal cliff is sort of like, it seems like that's the end of the road. So is the end of the road, is it a mathematical number, or is it somehow a loss of faith that we're capable of making hard and correct decisions?
Well, our problem as a country is not only that we owe a lot of money to ourselves, but we owe a lot of foreign governments and private institutions and individuals a great deal of money as well.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that if you think about how they're thinking, normally when a country gets into trouble in repaying its debts, it pays itself back before its foreign creditors, and so they tend to move first in anticipation of that sort of order of precedence, right? So, the concern has always been that someday we'll not be able to issue enough new treasury debt to cover the stuff that's already out there that's maturing, or that we'll have to raise interest rates in order to attract enough foreign capital to finance the debt. And that's ultimately what the Fed is doing by buying treasury bonds, is that they're eliminating the risk that the U.S. will have to raise interest rates to attract foreign investment in treasury bonds, because the minute we have to do that, it's game over, because we simply can't finance and refinance all this debt at higher interest rates, because we immediately fall into a cycle where we have to issue ever more debt in order to cover the expenses that we were trying to cover before interest rates went up. Right. So, in other words, our expenses are going up faster than we can issue new debt.
Mm-hmm.
So, ultimately, what the question is: what's going to trigger that event? And that's really nobody knows. I think most likely, it's going to have to do. My best guess would be some kind of oil shock, price shock that would perturb the system and get this cycle started.
The fact that we have a 1.6 10-year T-bill rate. What does that tell you in regards to deflation and inflation argument?
Well, you know, we don't have inflation because we still have an output gap left over from the so-called Great Recession, meaning that the economy is operating well under its capacity, its output capacity. That explains why Japan has been drifting in and out of inflation, deflation, or very low inflation. inflation rates and very low deflation rates now for over 20 years, is that they've been in that effort gap almost continuously ever since.
Mm-hmm.
And we're in one. So while you're there, inflation is not a problem, and I think we're going to be there for quite a while as well. So that explains why we're not seeing demand push inflation, but it doesn't mean that we're not getting some cost push inflation from rising oil prices. It's just that it doesn't tend to feed into the rest of the economy. There's nothing to reinforce it. But I don't think that the interest rates are connected very much to inflation risk, because there's the market for debt is always driven by government debt. Interest rates of all kinds of mortgages and corporate bonds are all driven by government interest rates, and the government interest rates are being driven by the government buying the debt itself, and also in its political arrangements with trade partners, particularly Japan and China, to purchase issuance at a rate that's necessary to maintain low rates.
We have only a couple more minutes. Do you see what's going on in the Eurozone as playing out poorly for our economy at some point?
Well, you know, that thing is such a mess. The euro was badly structured from the very beginning. I've always referred to it as half a currency because, yes, there's a central bank to manage inflation and provide liquidity, but there's no centralized treasury department like we have. There's no central IRS. There's no central tax authority or legislative authority setting tax policy. So all the things that make a real currency like the dollar, you know, only one of four components of a real currency are there. Because the thing is so misstructured, it was always ready to be tipped over. What tipped it over, of course, was the U.S. financial crisis. It was doing okay before that.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're in the situation where, you know, the political stresses between Germany, which, you know, way before the euro happened back in the late 80s and early 90s, when the structure of the euro was being debated, Robert Triffin was explaining the big concern was that if a European currency was ever devised, that Germany would become the milk cow
mm-hmm.
of the rest of Europe, because only Germany would be in a position as a major net exporter and capital goods and capital exporter would be in a position to support the system. And that has turned out to be exactly the case, and creates terrible problems politically for Germany. And so for political reasons, they have to do nonsensical things, economic things, like forcing Greece to go into a deep recession as if it's going to be able to pay its debts back if its economy is shrinking, which just doesn't make any sense from an economic standpoint. It makes perfect sense from a political standpoint.
Yeah, we only have 15 seconds left. Eric, I really enjoy talking with you, and I look forward to you being on the panel. It'll be an interesting night, and hopefully we'll get your opinion of what you think is next in our economy. Thank you so much again for joining us.
My pleasure, Bruce. Take care.
All right, Eric. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Adrenaline Athletics, Caldwell Banker Pioneer Real Estate, Elite Auctions, FIBI for Home Investors by Investors, Inland Empire Investors Forum, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Investor Experts Incorporated, Keller Williams of Corona, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, Mike Cantu, Northern California Real Estate Investors Association, Northern San Diego Real Estate Investors Association, Personal Real Estate Magazine, Realty 411 Magazine, Rick and Leanne Rossiter, Southwest Riverside County Board of Realtors, Stars Photography, UDirect IRA, Wilson Investment Properties, Tony Alvarez, Weston South Coast Plaza. See isurvivedrealestate.com for more on the event and all of the I Survived Real Estate sponsors.